Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In his inaugural address on January 20th, President Barack Obama vowed to restore science to its rightful place and wield technology's wonders to raise healthcare's quality and lower its costs. We will harness the sun and the winds and the soil to fuel our cars and run our factories, he said. The president also promised to transform our schools and colleges and universities to meet those demands. Those are the venues of the National Science Board, a panel of experts in every field of science and technology appointed by presidents for six-year terms to advise the presidents. The board also advises Congress on public policy issues and directs the course of the National Science Foundation. Here to connect the dots between the National Science Board, the foundation, and the president and Congress is Dr. Dan Arvizu. He is the director and chief executive of the U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory. Thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be with you, Ann.
He is also chairman of the Audit and Oversight Committee of the National Science Board. First of all, could you tell us what your day job is and what you do and how you came to be on the board 5 years ago? You're from the class of 2010, you said.
Yes.
Okay.
So each one of the National Science Board members are appointed for six-year terms, and every 2 years we rotate eight members off and we get eight new members. And the idea of that, of course, is that the stewardship of the national investment in science, in science engineering and education, is essentially, should essentially be managed by the same process that we essentially expect of our scientific community, which is merit-based, peer-reviewed. So there's this element of how the board actually does the oversight of the National Science Foundation, which is obviously the principal agency for science education and research in the country. The members on the committee, like myself, are members from the R&D community. So we're scientists. The way the legislation reads is that, prominent in your field and respected. So it's a great honor to be first nominated and then secondly appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate to be on the board. In my personal situation, I have been in the energy field for most of my career. Started at the Bell Telephone Laboratories and then worked at Sandia National Labs for many years and then ultimately in the private sector, CH2M Hill, where I was when I was appointed to this position. And at that time, the administration was looking for a balance on the board. And they were looking for somebody that had an energy background, somebody that had – that literally was in the marketplace and practicing. The board is primarily dominated by folks from academia.
Okay. So balance meaning private sector and academia.
And academia as well as discipline and as well as, the other, gender and ethnicity sorts of balances that
– What do you mean by discipline?
So engineering versus science.
I got – okay.
So I'm one of several engineers on the board, and we are, again, broadly it's technology, science, engineering, and math. So.
Okay. What are you in town for now? The whole board's in town.
Yes.
Tell me what you do. I think you meet four times a year. Four or five?
Sometimes as many as six times a
okay.
year. But the important thing in that we're doing here at in Columbus, Ohio, and at Ohio State University, being hosted by President Gordon Gee and the people here, which is fabulous, is really we get an opportunity once a year to get kind of away from Washington, D.C., and come out to a place where, science is actually being practiced and implemented. We love university campuses because this is where students are and a lot of vibrant environment. But we're on a retreat, and the retreat is really to allow us as board members to think longer term, broader perspective. What are the things that we can do here that will further the science and innovation agenda of the nation?
How long is your retreat?
It's a two-day retreat.
That is not a very long time to ponder the sciences of the universe and the world.
Well, fortunately, we are a small piece of a much broader mosaic. So the good news is that we have some help. The National Science Foundation staffs the board in many respects, and so a lot of the work that gets done to tee up what are the major priority issues are brought to us. And we act like a board, and so we don't get down into the minutia so much as we do broader concepts, broader prospects of what might we do different. I'll have to tell you that, after having been on the board now for 5 years, the National Science Foundation is an absolute marvelous organization and agency. It is the envy of the rest of the world, no question about it. Tremendous science going on here, and the interest that that other countries have in how this operation works is quite profound. So we try to make minor improvements, not to change too much too rapidly, but we do have to evolve with the changing times. And as you suggested earlier in your opening, you know, the president has made reinvigorating science and innovation a major tenet of the new administration's priorities. And we're about trying to accomplish that and make that happen.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you would like to join the conversation in a little while, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is WOSU 820. I am talking with Dr. Dan Arvizu. He's the director and chief executive of the U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory. But the National Renewable Energy Laboratory isn't actually at the Department of Energy.
That's correct.
Tell me about that relationship and how labs around the country are located not in the departments that they're identified with in the federal government.
Sure. I think that's an important part of, again, the scientific and R&D enterprise of the country is this mosaic of all of these research performers, which also includes many universities like we have here in Columbus and Ohio State. National labs in general, and they're primarily noted within the Department of Energy. There are like 17 national labs. They are managed. They're what they call government-owned but contractor-operated laboratories. It started back in the Manhattan Project in the 40s with Los Alamos and Livermore.
And worked for them then.
And it did. It did. It was a marvelous experiment that I think has been perpetuated over time. Recognizing that in order to attract the best scientists and engineers in the world, you really need to kind of practice private sector practices or public sector, you know, not be part of the government but be part of the private sector. So national labs kind of operate on that principle. So we are wholly owned by the government but in fact operated by managing and operating contractors who have a great deal of autonomy in essentially how they do the work. So the budget gets set by the Congress and the executive branch, but then national labs actually perform the work, and they do so in manners that are very conducive to, again, high degree of innovation and creativity. And not just the Department of Energy has national labs. There are national labs in all agencies, many agencies, Department of Commerce, in EPA being others. Certainly NSF has its own version of national labs also. So I represent the Renewable Energy National Lab, and it is the nation's designated research performer for promoting the acceptance of renewable energy and energy efficiency technologies into the marketplace.
Okay, what does that mean?
Well, so we do
into
research.
The marketplace.
We do research, and unlike what it happens within the Department of Science at the Department of Energy, and or what happens at the National Science Foundation, which is more discovery science based. It's, you know, very basic kind of research that really expands our knowledge and base. I'm in an agency where we are what we call essentially mission-oriented or use-inspired.
So sort of applied.
Very applied, connection with the marketplace, understanding both the market mechanisms and the financial investments that are necessary to actually move technology and innovation into the marketplace. That's a big gap between where we do basic science and where it finally gets into the marketplace. So we're kind of trying to build that bridge that takes you from basic science into useful, essentially business-creating market opportunities.
I'm not sure if it was you, but someone that I read from the National Science Foundation said that we have to shorten that gap, that things are moving so fast now. We can't afford to be using technology now that was in the National Science Foundation's on its budgets in the 1970s, that we need to be using technology now that was from 10 years ago or 5 years ago.
You're absolutely right. It gives me an opportunity to plug one of the major efforts that the National Science Board has undertaken over the past year. Dr. John Strauss and myself chaired a task force on sustainable energy. We've just released a report, just came out last month. It's called Building a Sustainable Energy Future, U.S. Actions for an Effective Energy Economy Transformation. And in there, we have a number of findings, and with the findings come recommendations. And one of those is precisely the one that you just mentioned. Innovation is great, but you've got to find a way to get that technology into the marketplace. I mentioned to you I'd been, you know, in the renewable energy business literally my entire professional career, almost 35 years now. And the things that we did literally in the early 1980s are just now finding their way into the marketplace.
For example?
Photovoltaics. The first 20% photovoltaic solar to electric conversion solar cell we had in the laboratory literally in 1980. Today, almost, 25 years later, is the commercial product that the vendors sell when you put solar panels on your rooftop, for instance. What I see in the laboratory today is absolutely phenomenal. And our challenge is to make sure that it doesn't take 25 years to get that technology into the marketplace.
Yeah, I think it was in an article I read about a deal that the National Renewable Energy Laboratory signed with RF Micro Devices,
right.
Regarding to develop a new generation of cells that convert sunlight to power. Is that what you're talking about?
That's one of those.
Okay.
Yeah, and I was part of that announcement. Well, we have a relationship with RFMD in this case, and their expertise is in manufacturing of RF devices that go into cell phones. I think they actually have like 70% of the cell phone market for these RF devices.
And God love them, because we've all had a cell phone go dead on us after plugging it in for 3 hours,
yeah.
And it doesn't last.
That's
now, that's
right.
Why our cell phones last longer now.
That's right, because they have essentially devices and new technology that uses less and less energy. And you build those devices through a process that you called molecular beam epitaxy, MBE. It's a very sophisticated way of essentially growing very thin microelectronic layers on one another. It's kind of computer chip technology, and we need that technology for building the next generation of solar cells. And the biggest foundry in the world is down in North Carolina, and so they're busy about doing that. And we are helping them transfer that technology so that they can get the manufacturing capacity for essentially a different kind of technology, essentially geared up for this new green economy that we're about. And so there's a lot of overlap between basic science, engineering, manufacturing, and the marketplace.
We're going to take a break right now. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. 74 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:19. Get more radio. The WOSU Fall Membership Drive begins soon, and you can help reduce the number of days. For every $20,000 we raise, we'll take one day off the drive. Visit WOSU.org/pledgefree for details. And WOSU Public Media and PBS present an epic story based on a radical idea that the most special places in the nation should be preserved, not for royalty or the rich, but for everyone. Beginning Sunday, September 27th at 8 p.m., watch Ken Burns' six-part series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea, on WOSU-TV. Visit WOSU.org for complete listings for the six-part series. And in the weather forecast, cloudy skies today, a good chance of rain showers and a high of 82. And now back to All Sides on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm speaking today with Dr. Dan Arvizu. He's the Director and Chief Executive of the U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory. And thanks again for joining us today. We were talking earlier about a compact, I suppose, or a deal partnership with mm-hmm. a private laboratory down in North Carolina that's developing the processes and the materials to capture energy in solar cells.
Mm-hmm.
What other kinds of contracts are out there? Well, first, let me ask this. How do you have these relationships without precluding other companies from getting into the market? When you have one company like that obviously it developed the technology,
right.
They deserve to benefit and profit from it. However, once the National Science Foundation jumps in and develops these relationships with them, how does anybody else get into it? How do they get your ear?
I think it's a very pertinent and relevant question. Let me back up a bit, because I think there's a whole spectrum of how the government, the executive branch, actually provides research funds to research performers like our laboratory, plus a number of what we call principal investigators at universities. And that whole spectrum is important to understand how that whole thing works. So the National Science Foundation funds, again, very basic kind of research that's within certain mission areas, discipline areas. And then that research furthers the state of knowledge. It furthers, the training of professionals in particular disciplines like biofuels or kinetics or bioconversion. And as that part of the R&D community begins to gain some momentum built on some findings and outcomes, then the private sector, first small businesses, entrepreneurs, they grab those technologies and they try to go start to commercialize those. And the ultimate value of many of these technologies is their end use application, and that whole spectrum of how do you get that technology in the marketplace is always the subject of a lot of discussion. The mission agencies, whether they be NASA or Department of Defense or Department of Commerce or in the case of my renewable energy lab, the Department of Energy, are focused on various mission objectives. So they'll fund additional work. And so this relationship that we have with RF Micro Devices down in North Carolina is really a cooperative research and development agreement. And they actually cost share much of what we do with them, so that is already a differentiator. Those that are closer to market will have a little bit more skin in the game, if you will. Mm-hmm. And the closer you get to that, obviously, the more cost share they will have. So that allows us to have a spectrum. So the National Science Foundation is more on the front end of that. The mission agencies are more on the back end of that. Universities run the whole spectrum, whether you're small businesses or large businesses. And we put mechanisms in place like what we call pre-competitive research.
Okay.
So it's a foundation that builds so that many players can come in and take advantage of that. And in the renewable energy area, we have a number of those topics that are doing that now.
You mentioned, we talk about the United States being the envy of the rest of the world. I think you mentioned that earlier in mm-hmm. terms of its science research and technology research. And just a moment ago, the president spoke to the world about how he thinks that if people are concerned about the United States acting in such a unilateral matter, they need to begin to act themselves and to help move forward the four pillars, as he mm-hmm. said. But one of them is not one of the four pillars, but one of the issues I'm wondering about, how the National Science Foundation or the National Science Board works with other countries and research in other countries. Is that possible? Does that happen?
Well, sure it does. In fact, I like to say, having been a manager of research efforts for many years, it's kind of hard to stop researchers from collaborating with their peers, okay. no matter where they are in the world. And it actually is a source of some phenomenal great relationships and some international goodwill that we fully haven't capitalized on. One of the things that we highlighted in our sustainable energy report that I mentioned earlier is this notion that we have to do a lot more international cooperation. Certainly, the issues that relate to climate change and energy, essentially economic growth based on energy development, green energy development, are not domestic issues, exclusively. Those are global issues and, in fact, need to be solved on a global basis. So many of the relationships that start with these R&D connections that we have among researchers, I think, are incredibly valuable. Now, what our studies have found, and my colleague Dr. John Strauss led an international science collaboration task force as well, and there's a report on that as well. What they tell us is that the U.S. government in the past has not been well coordinated agency by agency. It's kind of like everybody has their own agenda, the
different countries.
Department of Defense mm-hmm. has got certain strategic objectives. The National Science Foundation has others. Department of Energy has others. Department of Commerce has others. And what you find is that there's this broad spectrum of activity, none of which is really coordinated in any kind of what we would call nationalistic priority sort of way. So I think, you know, I certainly applaud the president for suggesting that we need to have international collaboration on energy. I heard his talk at the UN. I think it was the day before yesterday.
Right.
Yesterday.
I was going to talk about that too.
And,
right.
And the similar set of challenges that are in front of us. And I think it starts with basic international collaboration. The reason I make the comment that we're the envy of the world is, you know, I sat with the science communities of many different countries, including all of Europe and all of Asia, and we were in Beijing, China, and the national academies were hosting these meetings. And one of the things that kind of came out of that was really an aha moment for me personally was this notion that we have a very competitive merit-based peer-reviewed process in this country. And I know researchers are always, you know, highly, highly competitive, highly stressed in terms of going after money and funding and those kinds
right.
of things. It's actually a very good thing in terms of it really does make you hone your game. You have to be razor sharp. Many of the people who are foreign nationals that come and compete in our environment and do exceptionally well, when they go back to their home countries, their home country governments allow them to relax, and because they've kind of already achieved this level of success, don't challenge them in the same way that the academic community challenges R&D in this country. And that's a real asset to us that they actually envy because they believe that that's what keeps us sharp. So there's a lot of interesting give and take among the international community on how we manage those science collaborations.
How much does that opportunity to relax and rest on your laurels, to use the tired phrase, have to do with the fact that a lot of it is directly government funded and so there isn't the competition in there? And how is that – obviously, a lot of it comes from government funding here, but it's more competitive because it hasn't been an unlimited amount of money. But the new budget of $7 billion plus dollars for the National Science Foundation feels unlimited right now because it's a lot more money than you're used to working with, right?
Yes.
You just got $3 billion
from the stimulus
money.
Yeah. I would say this about those perspectives. Coming from the scientific community, I wouldn't be a good spokesperson for the science community.
I
would say we have enough money. In fact, what I see is an incredible amount of innovation, creativity, and enthusiasm. Certainly on campuses, when you go talk to those that are in the science arenas, we also recognize that if we're going to move forward as a country, we really need a lot more investment in our innovation platform, if you will. So STEM education, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math, I think has over the course of time been underfunded, certainly as it relates to mission agencies.
Yeah, I was noticing that in the press release regarding the budget. The math and science partnership, linking K-12 teachers with their colleagues in higher education, it said it will receive $58.2 million in fiscal year 2010. That doesn't seem – now, conversely to me,
yeah.
That doesn't seem like a lot of money to me.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the where your building
right.
blocks are.
And you have to invest early on. That K-12 is so important. I mean, you go back and you just look at the statistics. If a student is not taking algebra by eighth grade, they're really not on track to become a successful engineer and scientist. That means we need to redouble or triple our efforts at that other level because, in fact, I think we lose a lot of students early on, students who have the aptitude and in fact, perhaps even the motivation. But they, you know, maybe we haven't done as good a job in understanding what those career opportunities really relate to. And also, I think, you know, again, back to the economy, I think the economy will be greatly improved and enhanced by the notion of creating new high-paying jobs in the areas of innovation. You know, I know the president focuses on energy, but it's broader than energy. And I think the new science opportunities for the country really are the fact that a green economy really means high-paying jobs. And it's not just people installing rooftop solar panels. It's a lot more than that. And it means investment early on, certainly in basic sciences like we do at the National Science Foundation, certainly in the more applied sciences, but I think also and I think underrepresented in the education arena for STEM careers.
Is that a big increase over previous budgets?
It is, and we recognize that there has been a conscious decision on the part of Congress to double the science funding, and that includes the National Science Foundation, Office of Science within the Department of Energy, the NIST at Commerce, as a collection to try to double those budgets like we did with NIH, National Institutes of Health, over the next 10 years, and we need to be on track for that. So the budget increases that we're seeing, notwithstanding the recovery money stimulus.
The $7 billion be above and beyond the recovery money, or does it include it?
I think that's an annual appropriations budget, and I think it really is on the pathway toward getting toward that doubling that we talked about earlier.
Okay. Joining us now is University of Oklahoma meteorology professor and associate vice president for research, Kelvin Drogemeier.
Perfect.
Great. Thank you for joining us. A little late, but we're happy to have you here. And your colleague on the board, Dr. Arvizu, has been handling all the big
picture.
Oh, that's
the
good
big
to know,
picture.
Dan. Thank you.
But you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 820. We have a phone call right now from Ann on an issue I think probably Dr. Arvizu could talk about.
Yes. You mentioned earlier that the technology getting into the labs now is 1980. It's about 25 years old. Does that also apply to things like solar panels? Because my husband and I are looking to put solar panels on our roof, and if it's 25-year-old technology, that's troublesome to me. I don't know why it has to be 25 years old.
Yeah, let me clarify that. That's a great question. In fact, I just put solar panels on my roof as well. And the technology that I put was, in fact, that technology that we were pioneering in the laboratory 25 years ago. The fact of the matter is that when you build a small solar cell in the laboratory that's 20% efficient, in 1980, we had no way of knowing how much that would cost and how it would actually be manufactured and whether that would be a viable market product. It's taken a long time, and much too long, to get that technology into the marketplace. With a national focus, we could have moved that technology, in my opinion, in less than 10 years, cut that time by at least 2.5. My point I'm trying to make is that there is phenomenal innovation going on in our laboratories today, and that fundamental knowledge should not take us 25 years to get into the marketplace. I think we can accelerate that and put it in the marketplace tomorrow. So that said, let me give you some comfort. The technologies that the solar cell companies are selling today is state of the art in terms of what is commercially viable.
Okay.
And I think you shouldn't on the merit of its age delay in terms of what's viable. It's great technology. It works exceptionally well on my home, and I'm quite confident it'll work well on your home as well.
Dan and Kelvin both are in the class of 2010 with the National Science Board. That means you have one more year left on the board. You also have six-year terms. So you've seen a lot of change occur in the last 12 months, I suppose, since November was probably when it started to feel like change time. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, in an address to the United Nations on the issue of global warming, the president thoroughly embraced the concept of global warming, and those who have predicted dire straits if the nations of the world ignore the threat. We're going to hear from him now.
Rising sea levels threaten every coastline. More powerful storms and floods threaten every continent. More frequent droughts and crop failures breed hunger and conflict in places where hunger and conflict already thrive. On shrinking islands, families are already being forced to flee their homes as climate refugees.
Kelvin Drogemeier, this is kind of your bailiwick, the meteorology, and mm-hmm. Are we devoting enough resources now to the questions of storm study?
Well, I think we really have gotten our hands around the climate change issue in the sense of the fact that it is real. We do understand the increases of greenhouse gases and so on and so forth. We're working very hard now on improving models to increase their capability to predict uncertainty and that sort of thing. I think one of the things that we do need to focus on now, in addition to all of what we're doing, and that is not to displace that, but I kind of think of it's been said that weather is the delivery system of climate change. We need to be thinking about the local and regional manifestations of the global change, which can include hurricanes, droughts, things that the president mentioned. Very, very important. And we don't really have a nearly as good of an understanding of those local and regional impacts.
Yeah, you talked about In a Knight Ridder story from July, you said that the research community wants to look at hurricanes not just as a weather problem, but bringing in social behavioral science, the economic sciences. You said we're looking at predicting a hurricane as a complete total problem for society, not just as a weather event. Can you give me some examples of what you mean by that?
Right. Well, a really good one is human health, I think, for example. You look at human health, there are certain factors that people have, just physiological factors that make them vulnerable to disease or that sort of thing. But in fact, we know that human behavior plays as much of an impact on people's exposure to risk in terms of disease or some type of, you know, infection they might get or whatever. And so you really need a balanced approach. And part of the reason that we have such a good healthcare system, if we've looked not just at the genetic factors, the biological factors, the genome sequence, if we've actually looked at human behavior patterns and how people increase their susceptibility to disease and risk of exposure and that sort of thing by their actual behavior. And so we need something similar for the hurricane in terms of a balanced portfolio of understanding the physical science, the meteorology of hurricanes, but also how humans react to information conveyed to them, how that information ought to be developed, packaged, what that all means. And so it's really looking at a very broad, balanced portfolio like we've done in medicine.
Take Katrina. How could we – what sort of studies would help us react to something that massive today?
Yeah. You'll hear it said that Katrina was a very accurate weather forecast. In fact, it was extremely accurate.
Right.
The intensity was a problem. We continue to struggle with intensity forecasting. But in Katrina, what you saw was a breakdown of social infrastructure systems in terms of people not being able to evacuate. They had the so-called shelter in place. There was a displacement of large numbers of people that there really wasn't adequate preparation for that. So it's not just forecasting the weather. I mean, that's really only a small part of it. Is what do you do with that information and how do you react to it? And that's really a social human behavior science problem, not at all an atmospheric science problem.
We're going to take a quick break. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. Joining me today from the National Science Board, University of Oklahoma meteorology professor and associate vice president for research, Kelvin Drugemeier, and Dr. Dan Arvisu, director and chief executive of the U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory. The National Science Board's in town. We'll be right back.
Former Bush speechwriter Matt Latimer has written a new memoir that's making news with comments Latimer says President Bush made about Sarah Palin, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Latimer about being deputy speechwriter for the president and why he left the White House just before Election Day. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jurovich. Thanks for joining us this morning. 74 degrees in downtown Columbus. WOSU Public Media and PBS present an epic story based on a radical idea that the most special places in the nation should be preserved not for royalty or the rich, but for everyone. Beginning Sunday, September 27th at 8 p.m., watch Ken Burns' six-part series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. It's on WOSU-TV. You can visit WOSU.org for complete listings of the six-part series. And in the weather forecast, mostly cloudy skies, scattered showers, maybe a thunderstorm this afternoon, a high of 82. Clouds tonight and a slight chance of rain showers tonight as well, a low of 62 degrees. For Thursday, clouds and a slight chance of afternoon rain on Thursday, a high of 80. Looking ahead to Friday, partly sunny and a high of 78. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The National Science Board's in town, and I'm sure you always wonder, why would they come to Columbus? Joining me today to tell us about that is Dr. Kelvin Drugemeier. He is the, he's the meteorology professor and associate vice president for research at the University of Oklahoma. I didn't stop on your name, but I did on your title. And Dr. Dan Arvisu, you're the director and chief executive of the United U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory. If you would like to join the conversation, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Again, welcome aboard here. I mentioned it a little bit earlier about having a new president and change and all that kind of. How do you measure change right now? Is there any way to measure it? What's the difference is between the two administrations?
Well, so we always joke that, you know, things are moving more rapidly than ever before. I think we're finding that certainly to be the case. I think the thing that is for us most refreshing about the changes that are occurring, despite the fact that we've got these incredibly challenging conditions in our economic picture, is this focus on innovation and on science. I think we recognize that with all these attendant overlapping challenges that we have, kind of the one central ingredient of how we get ourselves out of this malaise is really to focus on innovation and science. And so, as the stewards of this, you know, tremendous national asset in the National Science Foundation, I think the board is you know, kind of re-energized, reinvigorated by this notion that okay, so now this has become even more important than we have all known it has been important, and quite frankly, you know, since the administration is also focused on it, and so it causes us to re-examine a number of things that we're doing. And to try to continue to capitalize on the successes that we've had in the past and improve the way we do things in the future.
Mm-hmm. What are you re-examining? What sorts of things?
One of the things that we've looked at recently, which is more of a policy type issue, is the engagement of higher education institutions in research and the shared mutuality of interest that they have with the National Science Foundation in actually conducting research and educating students. And so we've actually put in place a new policy where the institutions that actually receive grants from NSF are not required, in fact, are prohibited now from providing voluntary cost sharing to grants that fund them. And you might say, why would you bring that up? But the reason is that, in fact, those investments of dollars are very important for the institutions to make strategic investments in where they're going. And the work that is getting funded is both important to the NSF and to the institutions. We want a level playing field out there. And what we had before, when any institution could basically provide whatever amount of voluntary committed cost sharing they wanted, it would put institutions in an unequal playing field. Some institutions that are extremely well endowed, although I'm not sure that's the case with anybody these days, but it allowed them to sort of put a lot of money on the table, and other institutions that have extremely well-qualified faculty and students were really not as well capable of getting into the game. So now we see it being a truly broad enterprise, broadly engaging, where any institution out there can come and seek money from the NSF. And in fact, I think the peer review process, to add very quickly, is extremely good. Not to say that it was disadvantaging institutions that couldn't bring the cost sharing, but it was an open question. So we want to make sure to get on the safe side of saying, let's not have a policy that allows bidding wars to occur. And that's a very important policy decision by NSF for the National Science Enterprise.
And on the other side of the equation, it improves the prospects for smaller universities and colleges that have good stuff going on,
exactly,
but have a hard time attracting the top talent because they want to go where the money is.
You got it.
Is that right?
Yeah. So much of what we need to do going forward, I think, is to broaden the participation, as we like to say at the National Science Foundation, so more people can participate in that science enterprise going forward. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of participation, one of the goals of the stimulus package was to get jobs on the ground very quickly. We're doing it in Ohio with a lot of construction jobs. That's the sort of thing. They were looking for stuff that was already, you know, the blueprints were already done, ready to go. What do they call them? Shovel ready.
Right.
I don't know. With science, I just don't picture shovel. Is it
beaker ready?
Is it microscope or whatever people call them?
Ready. Yeah.
Well, how do you apply that challenge?
Well, it's a very important issue, I think. And in fact, NSF on a yearly basis leaves $2 billion of research unfunded that is judged meritorious by the peer review process. So in fact, if you think about where the $3 billion figure came from NSF, the stimulus money, about two-thirds of that really was geared toward let's take the research that's out there that has in fact been judged to be of high enough quality to be funded, and let's fund all of that we did not have money to fund before. And I'm very pleased to say, I just heard this morning, 80% of the stimulus money that NSF has actually been given has been encumbered, provided, and is actually working to create jobs. And so it's a very important statement. I think NSF is among federal institutions is really leading the way in getting that money to work to create jobs for our economy.
Because jobs aren't just about building roads. There are all kinds of jobs out there.
Right.
And scientists
right.
have to get a paycheck just like everybody else, right?
It's an investment in the future. Absolutely.
It is.
Let's take a call now. You're listening to WOSU 820. Gary, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. What would you like to ask?
Well, it's more of a comment. I really appreciate what the gentleman was just describing in terms of leveling playing field amongst higher educational institutions. And I would just encourage your listeners, whether they're prospective scientists or young budding scientists or engineers, to consider the different types or the variety of institutions where they can pursue their degrees and their undergraduate research. It seems that the public institutions, the larger universities, are the ones that get the majority of the press, majority of the attention when it comes to research, for good reason. But in terms of students, high school students or prospective college students who are considering a career in one of the STEM areas, to really consider some of the smaller colleges that are out there and the private colleges. I know lots of folks that have kids that are at some of these smaller institutions that are involved as undergrads in some incredible areas of research. And I guess part of the push is to keep some of these young people in Ohio. And there are a dozen or a couple dozen excellent small colleges that can give them universities as undergrads right out of high school, and prepare them very well for graduate schools, for PhD programs, for medical schools,
so,
et cetera.
So what are you asking the National Science Foundation to do? Just fund these schools, to fund the college education at the college education level and not necessarily the research level, or?
That's a very good question. I don't think I have an answer for. I really appreciate the fact that it seems like I've read about this Choose Ohio First scholarship fund and this new STEM initiative that is starting to make some funds available to families to help them finance college education.
Okay.
And I just think that, you know, anything that can allow some of the smaller institutions to partner up with these larger flagship research universities is a good thing by simply giving families and students more options to pursue their science goals.
Okay. I'm going to ask Dr. Kelvin Drogemeyer to address that issue.
Well, let me say you've got a very well-informed caller there. It's a great question. In fact, NSF has many programs underway. In fact, well, something called the Research Experience for Undergraduates Program, which really tries to get the funding to all kinds of institutions to support research at the undergraduate level. We, in fact, at our retreat are talking specifically about the issue of two-year colleges, junior colleges, and the role that they play in the entire educational system and how NSF can be involved with this pipeline. As the caller is really suggesting, there are a lot of other activities. In fact, NSF grants go to high schools and school systems. So there's probably a dimension of NSF that a lot of people don't really understand. It's not just the money going to the major research universities, but it's, as Dan mentioned earlier, it's a sort of broad cross-section and that we're trying to really reach. And not just throwing money out there, but being good stewards and doing it in a thoughtful way to where if we fund, you know, two-year colleges, we have an understanding of the impact that that's going to have on four-year institutions and on higher research institutions as well.
Okay, we have another caller. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Hi. You know, I have connections with both fellows. I had an NSF grant to study number theory up here at Ohio State when I was in high school in 1965. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The second thing is that I, for the National Renewable Energy Lab, I had an interview out there near the years of the Reagan administration.
Okay, Bob, what's your question?
I was just going to ask whether I'd have set it up. Are they involved in overcoming institutional barriers or simply to technical ones like I was told then?
Okay, hang on a second. They'll address that question.
Yes, in fact, that's a good question, Bob. Yeah. And I think what you'll find if you visited the National Renewable Energy Laboratory these days is many things have changed. And one of the main things that has changed is this notion that moving technology is into the marketplace has multiple dimensions, one of which is, of course, the technology development. But beyond that, there are market barriers, there are policy considerations, there are financial implications. And so scientists and engineers these days need to be multidisciplinary. They need to understand all those economic as well as policy intricacies so that they can fashion and formulate market solutions, because I think ultimately the marketplace is going to decide on these technologies how our economy, both in energy and other sectors, will evolve. And so these institutions, the National Science Foundation funds and the ones that the Department of Energy funds, all I think are becoming a lot more interdisciplinary, and many of our practitioners now have to be much broader. And so it kind of brings up all the attendant, you know, you have to have good communication skills and project management skills and just be a much broader, rounded individual. And I think that'll serve our profession well as we move into the next century.
We have an email from Mary. She asks, do you ever have to advise, consider the moral aspects of public policy issues involving science and engineering? Since this is a panel appointed across presidential terms, do you feel you are, for the most part, insulated from politics? That's kind of two questions. So first, I guess, do you have to consider the moral aspects of your public policy? Are you asked to do that? Is that part of your mission?
Well, let me start. I think this is a very deep question and has, I think, a lot of very important implications to it. Certainly, the notion of having a 24-member board has kind of in its premise this notion that we need all points of view, and that all points of view need to be publicly debated and discussed before we get to the point of making and drawing conclusions. So one of the things that the National Science Board does is in fact does provide policy guidance and does provide recommendations to the President and Congress. I mean, ultimately, the decision making resides with executive branch and legislative branch in many of these issues. But our role is to provide scholarly input into very difficult questions. So yes, we grapple with all of the tough questions, whether they regard moral or ethical implications. It's not always clear that we have a crisp answer. But I think many of these things deserve and require a thoughtful consideration. And I think that's what we're about. No one individual can dominate that conversation. And as a result, I think we come up with a better conclusion.
I just – before we get to Mary's second question, has the board expanded over time? Did it used to be – it's always been 25 –
24 members that are appointed by the president, and then an ex officio participation by the National Science Foundation director.
Okay. And then Dr. Drogermeyer, how about Mary second? Since this is a panel appointed across presidential terms, do you feel you are, for the most part, insulated from politics?
Well, let me just say, Ann, that I'm very impressed with the caller's questions there. It's a very important question. In fact, the National Science Foundation is unique in the federal government in the sense that it doesn't report to a cabinet agency. So the National Science Board was constructed specifically to provide an independent voice of policy guidance to the President and Congress. So in fact, if you say, what is the NSF? It actually is the National Science Foundation director and the board, and that's basically the organic language that created the NSF. So we are in a unique position, I think, of actually being able to speak much differently than some of the other groups in the country to provide very, very honest, unfettered guidance to the President and Congress. And that's a very unique role that we have, and we take it very seriously, in fact.
How unfettered? I'm trying to visualize. I imagine most of your advice comes in the form of reports, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. Is anyone ever – does the president take any personal interest in talking to people personally about these issues on the board?
Well, so certainly I think the chairman of our board, Dr. Steve Bearing, represents the voice of the board. And, okay. and he's frequently called to meet with officials both in the cabinet and the White House and whatnot. And typically what you'll find is that he stays very close to the reports that we produce as a group. And so there comes to be a time when I think you can say things and then you can back away from things. Like in our report on sustainable energy, I'll just give you an example. We make a strong statement that policy is necessary. We stop short of saying what policy. What mechanism might you use?
You may lay out the alternatives.
Right. That's correct. So it is trying to provide thoughtful input, but not usurp the authority of what the Congress and essentially the president are elected to do, and as such, we hope that we add constructive input into that discussion.
Kelvin Drogermeyer, you've compared the money that's been channeled to hurricane research, mm-hmm. and all the ancillary issues to the money that's been channeled to earthquake
research
right.
and that sort of thing. And that's been viewed in some places as a little political. But you've always been quick to explain that away. And can you explain it now?
That's a good point. And in fact, what we did was we actually looked at the hurricane community as really a role model for us. It wasn't an us versus them proposition. We actually looked at all natural disasters and said, you know, hurricanes really have not received the amount of funding and attention and coordination that we need to have because a lot of people are still dying. And partly that's due to the fact that we have looked at the hurricane not entirely as a weather problem, but more importantly, not as a weather-driven social science problem. So we look to the hurricane community as really a great example of how to mobilize, how to organize, and certainly there are political dimensions to that. But really what our report called for was a serious research initiative that was coordinated and thoughtfully put together that really allows us to attack the key problems that are causing so many people to die. Even this tremendous age of technology and great forecasts and great communication and warning systems, we are seeing a lot of people die. And that to me means that we're not doing the complete job that is possible to avoid that loss of life.
Okay. And we were talking earlier about the $3 billion from the stimulus package. You said you had 80% of it.
Roughly 80%, I think, has been allocated. Provided. Yeah.
In our country, Americans tend to have this, what are you doing for me lately feeling. I know that from daily journalism. And also about the science that we fund in this country. And with this all this new money coming in and the hopes to double that amount by 2016, what accompanying pressure is brought to bear to make something of it, to produce something?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a couple of ways to answer that question. And you know, it's kind of a good news, bad news story. You know, because the bad news is we've underinvested in our innovation infrastructure for a long time. And we've really not put the mechanisms in place to really take full advantage of that. I think what the Recovery Money Act has provided is a forum by which essentially we can kind of kickstart much of what we believe is the real value of innovation that many times is a long-term campaign. So the short-term opportunity is what I call harvesting the investments of the past. And I think there's a real opportunity to do that. Some of that requires getting some policies changed. But the fact of the matter is I think there is a way in which we can responsibly spend, you know, a significant amount of government taxpayer, you know, precious resources that will have a lasting impact. And, you know, some of these things, you know, will kind of play out and then the proof of the pie will be in the eating. And when we look back several years from now, we'll say, you know, how well did we do? I'm confident that there's certainly potential to do it right and the verdict is still out. But I think there really is good opportunity in the science arena, I think, to make investments that we simply have not been able to make in the past.
I would just add, Anne, real quickly, that the Science Board takes extremely seriously the stewardship role that it has of taxpayer dollars. We understand that the taxpayers are providing the money, and on all the decisions we make, the tremendous scrutiny we put all of ourselves under, the hard questions we ask about proposals to make sure before we award any amount of money that we are absolutely sure that everything has been done properly. You know, it's a lot of money. $6.5 billion is a lot of money, and the growth path to say $12-13 billion is equally substantial. But I just want the folks to know that we take that very, very seriously because we ourselves are taxpayers. We don't want anybody to misuse or misappropriate our funds, and we're very, very serious about that.
Pressure is the wrong word, but I'm going to use it anyways. Maybe another word is imperative to establish priorities that do help bring our economy back. Everyone keeps saying it's going to be something from science, technology. It's going to be the new energies. It's going to be any number of things. But how much imperative is it to develop those? Is that a priority? Do jobs become a priority?
Well, I think one of the things that we did talk about in the sustainability report, and again, that focuses on energy. But, you know, we recognize that there is certainly an opportunity to create a green economy based on a new set of parameters, some of which requires policy intervention. But At the bottom line, there are big gaps, and one of the big gaps is a workforce of the future.
Okay.
Who are these workers? How are they going to be developed? And I think there is a government role to help encourage that.
And that's where the funding for starting at the K through 12 level begins.
Right.
We're out of time. It's been great. I really enjoyed talking with you today. University of Oklahoma meteorology professor and associate vice president for research, Kelvin Drogemeyer, and Dr. Dan Arvizu, director and chief executive of the U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory. They are members of the National Science Board. You are listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.